Today, Michael Gove and Dominic Cummings want to rewire government and move much of it out of London. But can they succeed? The plush surroundings of the Ditchley Park country estate near Chipping Norton in Oxfordshire are an unusual place to try to start a revolution.
If the suggestions for change that I put forward are wrong or mistaken, which they may honestly be, I hope the response is to call for greater radicalism, not less.
But that's where Cabinet Secretary Michael Gove chose to promise a major shake-up of one of Britain's most constant and most caricatured institutions, the civil service.
Minister, I have something to say to you which you may not like to hear.
Why should today be any different?
Gove's promised revolt is being carried out with Downing Street's chief strategist, Dominic Cummings, as the men who drove Britain to Brexit turn their attention to Whitehall, that they say is too metropolitan and too unwilling to take risks. Within hours of the speech, they had their first scalp as the head of the civil service, Mark Sedwill, announced his departure.
The short letter left much to be read between the lines. He told the Prime Minister, "We have agreed that I will stand down and leave government service at the end of September."
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, taming Sir Humphrey. Can the civil service be reformed? Jonathan Powell is one of the few people who have done the job that Dominic Cummings is doing now. He was chief of staff to Tony Blair. When Powell entered Downing Street in 1997, a few minutes before his boss, the first thing he did was shake hands with the head of the civil service, Robin Butler. That marked the shift from opposition to government, from pumping out ideas in press releases to taking charge of more than 400,000 officials meant to turn them into a reality.
We had to make the adaptation from being a campaign into actually managing the civil service and using the Cabinet Office to drive the government machine. Because in a way, Number 10 is very small, it's like a gear stick. And the Cabinet Office is like the gearing mechanism that connects it to the rest of government. And we had to try and make that work properly. And it was quite difficult. I remember Tony complaining to me about after 9 months, a year, that he felt the civil service was a Rolls Royce sitting outside Downing Street and he was never allowed to get in it and drive it himself.
So when comedies like Yes Minister caricature that relationship between civil servants and political advisers in a way that suggests the civil service is really quite resistant to change.
The questions of administrative policy can cause confusion between the policy of administration and the administration of policy.
Is that close to reality?
Well, Robin Butler, the Cabinet Secretary, when we came into government in 97, used to say that Yes Minister was a documentary, not a comedy.
Especially when responsibility for the administration of the policy of administration conflicts or overlaps with responsibility for the policy of the administration of policy.
And I think there is some truth to that, although, of course, it was made for a time, for a period. It was made about the 1970s. And it was true that in the 50s, 60s and 70s, civil servants had acted in that way. By the time we came to the 90s, it was different. The civil service has been a century or more being formed. It has a very strong culture, a very strong history. And they tend to live, to a certain extent, in the past because they have traditions. And these traditions are very important. It protects us from the sort of excessive politicisation and the, indeed, corruption that you see in many other countries through the public service. That is an important thing to preserve. But the danger, the other side of that is that people get very stuck in the old ways and find it difficult to adapt. When we came in, we were enthusiastic. The civil servants were enthusiastic. But I do remember a briefing by the Home Office. They came in to brief us on crime. And they came in lots of graphs showing crime going up. And I asked, why is crime going to go up? Why are you predicting that in a confident way? And they said, well, because the economy is going up. And as the economy is going up, people are richer and there's more stuff to steal. And I said, oh, well, what would happen if the economy turned down? Oh, they said crime would go up because people would be poorer and they'd have to steal more stuff. So there's a sort of sense of fatalism in the civil service that's quite difficult to battle, because they've seen it all before. They've had ministers come and go. They've usually seen the proposals you come in with and you think are brilliant and new. They've already thought about them and seen 100 problems in them. So trying to overcome that fatalism, trying to encourage them to see that things can be done, even if they have failed in the past, is quite challenging. And that's the real job of a minister, is to persuade the civil servants that, yes, they think this is a terrible idea. Yes, they thought about it before, but maybe this time it could be made to work.
OK, so it sounds like the difficulties you faced in the late 90s are not that dissimilar to what the cabinet minister Michael Gove and the man who now has the job you once did, Dominic Cummings, are articulating now. They've both had frustrations with the civil service ever since the Tories came to power in 2010, and they were at the Department for Education. They felt officials briefed against them and that the whole establishment was resistant to change. Gove famously called it the blob.
Mr. Gove has seen himself as locked in a struggle with this little fella, the blob, the amoebic slime emblematic of the quangos and institutions that are meant to stand in the way of radical change.
Now he's in charge of civil service reform, so he's got his chance and he set out this vision.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, to Ditchley's annual lecture by the Right Honourable Michael Gove.
And he set out his plans to take on the establishment by giving a traditional lecture at a stately home and starting with 1930s political philosophy.
The Italian Marxist thinker Antonio Gramsci defined our times. The crisis consists precisely of the fact that the inherited is dying and the new cannot be born.
And he set out three main arguments. Can I put each of them to you? First, this sense that a civil service based in London can feel very disconnected, particularly from many of those who voted for Brexit.
Government departments recruit in their own image, are influenced by the think tanks and lobbyists who breathe the same London air, and are socially rooted in assumptions which are inescapably metropolitan. We can literally reduce the distance between government and people by relocating government decision-making centres to different parts of our United Kingdom.
And Michael Gove says there's a simple solution. Move the government departments out of the capital. That's sensible, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But what it isn't is new. Go back to the 1960s. This is exactly what Harold Wilson wanted to do. He wanted to get the civil service out of London and out into the regions of the country. And every prime minister since then has tried to do the same thing. And Thatcher tried to do it, Blair tried to do it. The problem is actually making it happen in practice. The thing that struck me about Michael Gove's speech, which was an interesting speech, and the revolutionary references to Gramsci were a typical trademark, but there wasn't much revolutionary in what he was proposing. And he didn't suggest any new solutions to making it happen in practice. And I can explain why ministries don't move out of London. And the answer is ministers, because you can move an institution that is just delivering. You can move customs and excise to different parts of the country. But ministers want to have their civil servants near them. And ministers have no intention of leaving London. They want to be near Westminster. They have to go and answer questions in the House of Commons. And if their civil servants are hundreds of miles away, they find it very, very difficult to get the sort of support that they want. Large bits of government have moved out, but mainly what they do when they move out is provide jobs, which is a good thing in itself. What it doesn't do is change the attitude of the mandarins, because the mandarins are still recruited from the same people, and they're all going to still be working in Westminster and Whitehall. And no prime minister so far has managed to do that. Now, if Michael Gove were to say, I am going to take the cabinet office and stick the cabinet office in Teesside, and I don't mind that all my advisers are going to be there, then he could do it. But I bet he doesn't.
I can see that it might be complicated for a cabinet minister who's also a constituency MP, who also needs to be in parliament, to have a third place that they have to get to in the country. But if they think that this is important, if they think that there is this disconnect, isn't it right to make that change? I can see you think it won't happen, but do you think it should happen?
Oh, I think it would be a very good thing if it did happen. I mean, interesting things happened during coronavirus. We've now experienced that we can do many things remotely. We can do lots of our meetings remotely. They managed to have cabinet meetings remotely. So actually, there's now a bit less of an excuse for ministers to refuse to leave London.
And why do the advisers have to be in London? They don't have a Westminster problem. They don't have a Parliament problem, do they?
No, the problem is not for them. They obviously mainly don't want to move. You know, they're accustomed to living in London and that's where they want to stay. You'd probably have to recruit new people to fill these jobs, but that too would be a good thing because that would change the attitudes of the people you're recruiting. If you said that the Cabinet Office is going to be in Teesside from now on, you'd probably have a different cast of characters.
Government must also ask itself if its people have the skills necessary for the challenges that I've set out.
The second point is around who the civil servants are and this idea that Whitehall is stacked full of humanities graduates. Gove said,
"There are many brilliant people in our civil service, and I've never come across any civil servant who didn't want to do his or her best for the country. But nevertheless, there are a limited number, even in the senior civil service, who have qualifications or expertise in mathematical, statistical and probability questions. And these are essential to public policy decisions."
There was a need for more data and statistical skills. So ironically, he was using the speech to call for more experts. And he also argued that the way you get promoted in the civil service comes from switching roles and departments. So you end up with generalists rather than specialists.
"We must be able to promote those with proven expertise in their current role to perform the same or similar functions with greater status and higher rewards without them thinking that they have to move away from the areas they know and love to rise in their profession."
What did you make of that?
Well, first I want to say that I think it's a bit ironic that an arts graduate from Oxford should be proposing this, backed up by another arts graduate from Oxford in the form of Cummings, another arts graduate from Oxford in the form of Boris Johnson. I might point out I'm an arts graduate from Oxford as well. So there is a deep bias in our society and our institutions from that point of view, and changing it will not be easy. Again, it was a deja vu all over again. And what's interesting is how many of these problems you can take straight back to the Fulton Report in the 1960s. You know, Harold Wilson had been pretty fed up with the way the civil service was operating. He himself had operated during the war in the civil service as well as a politician. And the recommendations of that Fulton Report on the reform of the civil service, the same things we hear about today from Michael Gove, one of Fulton's main recommendations, and this was particularly something Harold Wilson wanted, was to get scientists, mathematicians, the white heat of technology, you'll remember. So Fulton really pushed for this. He said, we've got to get away from classicists and those sort of things. And it has happened, but it hasn't happened nearly enough. And Gove is right to ask for that. And we were right to try and push for it too when we were in government. It's something that happens only very slowly. The generalist point, again, that Michael Gove refers to, again, is something that was in Fulton and every prime minister since then. How do you get people to be more specialised in their jobs? And the trade-off here is quite a difficult one to resolve. You want people to be experts, you want people to be specialists, to really know about some particular aspect of the health service or some particular aspect of tax policy. But the danger is that if they stay there too long, say they're there 20 years, you find they get a bit stuck in a rut. They are even less innovative than they would have been when they first came to the job, seen everything before.
The final part of Gove's thesis is that there's this kind of inbuilt tendency to be cautious, almost an institutional disincentive to take risks and think outside the box.
There are so many barriers to doing things differently in government, so many incentives to play safe. If you decide that you will procure services from a new organisation, and if things go wrong, you'll face the wrath of the National Audit Office, the criticism of self-righteous chairs of parliamentary select committees, and the hindsight-rich rancour of newspaper columnists, as well as the disappointed foi d'oeuvre of your permanent secretary and secretary of state.
Is that fair?
Yes, it is. David Cameron talked about enemies of enterprise.
The bureaucrats in government departments who concoct those ridiculous rules and regulations that make life impossible, particularly for small firms.
You had Tony Blair talking about the scars on his back.
People in the public sector are more rooted in the concept that if it's always been done this way, it must always be done this way, than any group of people I've ever come across.
The problem they were talking about is when a prime minister comes in, freshly elected, he wants to get things done. And all too often what it feels like to him is the civil servants are saying to him, that can't be done, this can't be done, have you thought about that problem, what about this problem? And there is a culture in the civil service that is not problem solving. It is pointing out the 200 problems about why something can't be done. Now, that is necessary. We do need the civil servants to warn of the elephant traps a minister is about to walk into. Again, playing back to Yes Minister.
I've realised how to reform the educational system.
Excellent, Prime Minister. I'm going to let parents take their children away from school and move them to any school they want.
Well, you mean after application, scrutiny, tribunal hearing and appeals procedures?
Then they should be solutions. You shouldn't just turn up with the problems, you should turn up with the solutions. And that is a big cultural change. It is happening in the civil service, and it is happening more in some parts than others. But it's a difficult thing for them to get the balance right.
Coming up, Jonathan Powell seems to agree with Michael Gove. So what's his problem? Jonathan, it seems to me that at every stage you're articulating a frustration for politicians with the civil service around the idea of them resisting change. And it sounds like you agree with large parts of Gove and Cummings' critique. And yet you've called Cummings Rasputin, and he's allegedly described you as a moron who's joined a Looney Tunes conspiracy gang. What's your problem with what they're doing?
I have no problem at all with Michael Gove's speech. My only problem with it was it didn't seem to have any new ideas in it. Frankly, all of the ideas in the Gove speech can be found in the Fulton Report in the 1960s. The problem is, what are the new ways of trying to put it into practice? And what I object to is the way that Cummings is trying to put it into practice. I think it is very unwise, even from his own point of view, to declare war on the civil service and to talk about a hard rain falling on the civil service. I think it's very unwise to sack the cabinet secretary in the way they did and to bring in cronies in places like the National Security Advisor. I think the effect of that, you'll get passive resistance from the civil service. They will simply stop things happening. They will quietly refuse to cooperate with you. Because in the end, what we discovered was you need the civil servants to deliver the change. If you want change to happen, you need to persuade them. You need to carry them with you. You don't declare war on them. You don't insult them. That does not help.
So your accusation is that they're politicising the civil service, but aren't governments always accused of that when it comes to advisers?
The point of having special advisers is actually to protect the civil service from politicisation. I was a special advisor. I was recruited by Tony Blair. When Tony Blair left through the front door in 2007, I left through the back door. I wasn't able to stay, even if I'd wanted to, in those circumstances. And that helped protect the permanent civil servants in Number 10 and elsewhere in the government from that politicisation. The problem with what they're doing is they are putting people into civil service jobs, apparently, at least in one case, on the basis that they are an avowed Brexiteer. I don't think that's a sensible thing to do, because otherwise you do lose that advantage we gained in the 19th century of having an apolitical, independent civil service. So I have no problem with appointing SPADs to do different things. But if you actually then make the machinery of government politicised, you will regret it. And if you look at the American system that the government have pointed to in trying to defend what they've done, I know the American system very well indeed. And I've actually advocated some aspects of it here, which would be useful. But the actual politicisation of having the top 2,000 jobs all filled by political appointees is pretty disastrous. The Trump administration, for example, has not managed to fill all those jobs in the time of Trump as being president. And when it is filled, it becomes very, very politicised. If you look at the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, it's very hard for it to do its day-to-day work because ideology has been introduced into every level of what it does. So I strongly would not argue for going down the American route if that's what the government really intend to do.
But they're nowhere near that. Do you think there's a longer-term risk?
I do think there's a risk with the approach that Cummings and Johnson are taking to the civil service. If you look at Hungary and Poland, and of course we're not Hungary and Poland, and I hope we'll never become Hungary and Poland in terms of what's happened to them and their democratic system. But the first steps the populist governments in those two countries took when they came in was to start undermining their public service. They started dismissing people, bringing in their own people. They were very disparaging about the public service. Then they moved on to the public broadcaster, took that over, made it propaganda arm for themselves. Then they moved on to the judiciary. And you ended up with systems that are very authoritarian, where a lot of the checks and balances are removed.
In terms of the reforms that Michael Gove set out in that speech, so the bit that you agree with, it's easy to dismiss this kind of thing as a waste of time and energy, especially when we're in the middle of a terrible health crisis, Brexit is coming, there's a likely recession. But they're clearly determined. And given that this is something that has been repeated time and again over the decades, I'm just interested in what is the end game? What is the prize for going through this type of pain to reform?
If you can actually get the government system to be leaner, more efficient, if you can cut out a lot of the red tape, if you can make it more responsive at the local level rather than centrally controlled, all of our lives would be a lot better. Even just thinking of the COVID crisis, if we had a more efficient system, you wouldn't end up with letters not being delivered to Leicester Council or Leicester Council not replying to the letters in time. And that would have an effect on whether Leicester had to be locked down or not. So there are nitty-gritty things that flow from being able to bring about civil service reform. Government has been unbelievably bad at big projects. In France, government can actually manage big projects remarkably well. If they want to transform the road system, they have a very effective way of doing it. We've been extremely bad about that. When it came to putting NHS records electronically, when we were in government, that was a failure. People sometimes don't realise quite how much what the civil service does, what the public service does, affects everything that happens in their lives.
Ultimately, we're in a situation where in 2020, Michael Gove can stand up and give a lecture that, in substance, could be very similar to a speech Tony Blair might have given about the civil service in 1997, which, in turn, as you have pointed out, is very similar to what was said in the Fulton Report in the 1960s. It's borderline absurd. If these ideas are equally valid now as they were in the 60s, clearly things aren't changing that much, at least if you believe what the politicians are saying. So finally, I just want to ask you, why aren't things changing? If you want to reform the civil service, how do you actually do it? And is there not an argument that successive governments have tried the gradual approach and maybe made some changes, as you've suggested, but nowhere near enough, then something radical needs to happen instead?
I doubt that it's going to be possible to be completely transformational in one go. I think there's a reason it's been a battle going on since 1960 to bring about this change. It's not, it'd be wrong to say there've been no changes. Yeah, there is more. The civil service does now look more like the public it serves than it did in 1960. It is more efficient at many things. It can do project management. We have much more flexibility. We have five-year contracts rather than people coming in from the cradle and staying till the grave. So I think it'd be wrong to say there hasn't been any change in the civil service. It just happens at a slower pace than the politicians want to have. And I think if you approach it as a war, as a hard rain, it's going to take even longer and be less successful.
It doesn't feel that satisfying, but basically you're saying gradual improvement is the best we can hope for.
I think the gradual improvement would make a big difference to people's lives, and that's why it's worth trying to achieve. A revolution in the civil service strikes me as pretty unlikely, and I'm not even sure we would feel better if that happened. We'd probably have a dislocation in the process that would make our lives a whole lot worse.
So has Sir Humphrey gone or not?
Sir Humphrey has changed. He's still got a Sir. He's probably still called Humphrey. He's probably still an Oxford graduate, but he is different from his grandfather.
Sir Humphreyism lives on. Jonathan Powell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Powell. Do follow our Westminster team at theguardian.com, where you can read stories about this from Rajiv Sayal. And do keep up with all the daily politics with Andrew Sparrow on his brilliant live blog. We wanted to get the data behind these civil service reforms, so we went to the Cabinet Office to find out, firstly, how many civil servants are based in London. The answer is 89,000. That is a big number and a slight increase in recent years. And we know the headquarters of many departments are in the capital, but it does mean that 4 out of 5 civil servants are based in other regions and nations of the UK. The next biggest number, around 55,000, are in the Northwest. In terms of this Oxbridge Arts graduate point, the Cabinet Office doesn't hold data on how many civil servants have maths or science degrees, so we weren't able to find that out. It certainly is true that there is an Oxford and Cambridge bias at the very top. In 2019, 56% of permanent secretaries, that is the most senior role in a department, went to one of those two universities, according to the Sutton Trust. But we don't know how many of them did art subjects. That's it for today. My thanks to Jonathan Powell. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.